I think that she is a Democrat posing as a Republican, and she should have voted on the complete repeal.
Alaskans weigh in on Senator Murkowski's role in the healthcare debate. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, July 27th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a pilot is presumed dead after a plane crash in Lake Clark National Park.
Park rangers and state troopers will be going to the site of the crash for recovery operations this evening.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
Midnight Oil is brought to you with generous support from the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
The Alaska Dispatch News is reporting that the Trump administration threatened to target Alaska as retribution for Senator Lisa Murkowski's stand against Republican efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act this week. Because Alaska's energy interests could be at stake, we asked some Anchorage residents how they feel about Murkowski's vote and if they're worried about the consequences. Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk has more.
The story stated that Senator Murkowski and Senator Dan Sullivan received calls from Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke yesterday. During that call, Zinke reportedly told Sullivan that issues like the King Cove Road, drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and the placement of Alaskans in leadership positions at the Interior Department could be at stake. Sullivan responded to an NBC reporter asking about the call regarding Murkowski's healthcare vote.
The sooner we can get back to cooperation between the administration on these issues and the chairman of the Energy and Natural Resources Committee, the better it's going to be for Alaska, the better it's going to be for the country, particularly on the issues of resource development, energy dominance that the secretary talks about that has to include Alaska.
Murkowski is chair of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. A spokesperson for Sullivan has not returned several calls for comment. The Interior Department also has not responded to a request for comment. A spokesperson for Senator Murkowski's office confirmed that she received a call from Interior Secretary Zinke yesterday. The spokesperson said Zinke told Murkowski that the president was displeased with her vote on the health care bill, but the spokesperson declined to elaborate further. This follows a tweet from the president yesterday criticizing Murkowski's vote, stating that she, quote, let the Republicans and our country down. So how do Alaskans feel about all this? I went to the busy Fred Meyer in Midtown Anchorage to find out. Zachary Stevens was there to pick up water before a fishing trip when he stopped to talk about Murkowski's vote.
I think that she is a Democrat posing as a Republican, and she should have voted on the complete repeal.
Stevens says he thinks Murkowski should act based on what Alaskans want, not just on what the Trump administration wants her to do. But he doesn't think Murkowski should ignore the potential consequences of her vote.
I hope that that Senator Murkowski does what's in the best interest of Alaskans. So if she's getting that kind of pressure about energy and stuff from the presidential administration, that she does what's going to be right for her constituents.
Anchorage resident William Gooch, who was also on his way into Fred Meyer, had a different view on Murkowski's stand.
I think, you know, she's got some principles, bearing in mind that we're grading on a curve, you know. So, yeah, I'm glad she did the vote.
Gooch didn't have much time for the Interior Secretary's actions.
And did you hear about what the Interior Secretary did yesterday when he called her and sent Sullivan?
Yeah, that's bullshit.
Can you say something a little more radio-friendly about that?
Yeah, that's just a bunch of crap. I'm not paying much attention to what these guys are tweeting on their little tweeters.
Murkowski isn't up for re-election until 2022. In an emailed statement, Murkowski said, "While I have disagreed with the Senate process so far, the president and I agree that the status quo with health care in our country is not acceptable and reforms must be made." The senator added she is committed to pushing for an open process to ensure Alaskans receive affordable health care. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
The Alaska legislature passed the state's capital budget today, allowing road projects and other construction to move forward. It was the only piece of business for the third special session, which lawmakers called themselves. It came and went in about 6 hours today. The capital budget is nearly $1.5 billion, the lowest amount in 17 years. Most of the funding is from the federal government. Nome Democratic Representative Neil Foster says the budget bill was a compromise.
We wanted to ensure that construction projects move forward without delay this summer. We wanted to bring in over $1 billion in federal matching funds back to Alaska. And we wanted to see that thousands of Alaskans continue to work in good-paying construction jobs.
The budget included money for oil and gas tax credits, community assistance, and a new school in Kivalina in Northwest Arctic Borough. The community assistance allows every municipality and borough to receive at least as much from the state this year as it received last year. Anchorage Democratic Representative Les Guerra says this aid is important.
For a modest $8 million, we said let's keep that at last year's level and not keep doing damage to communities. And I think that's a good thing. It's a good thing for public safety. It's a good thing for local taxpayers.
Perhaps the most controversial piece of the capital budget was a decision to move half of the funding the state set aside for a Juneau Road extension toward other projects. Anchorage Republican Representative Lance Pruitt says funding projects like the road would contribute to ending the state's recession.
And that's showing the business community, that's showing the international community that we are willing to pay our debts.
Pruitt proposed an amendment to keep the money designated for the road. The proposal was defeated in a conference committee meeting. Some members of the Republican House Minority Caucus criticized the process that led to the capital budget. They said it didn't allow for their input. The compromise bill was released Wednesday and went through the entire process in today's one-day session. Recovery efforts are underway for what is believed to be a fatal aircraft accident in Lake Clark National Park. Park spokesperson Megan Ricochet says a Park Service aircraft with rangers was launched this morning to search after an emergency locator beacon signal was picked up around 9:30 a.m.
They did locate the ELT and found a downed and still burning aircraft in Miller Creek, which is on the north side of Lake Clark itself.
According to Riche, Regal Aviation out of Anchorage reported that the pilot, whose name has not been released, was the only occupant on board the Cessna 206.
Alaska State Troopers are en route to Port Ellsworth with a helicopter, and park rangers and state troopers will be going to the site of the crash for recovery operations this evening.
Riche says she doesn't know what the flight plan was for the Regal Cessna 206. The NTSB will be investigating the accident. Federal authorities are charging a Utah man in the murder of his wife aboard a cruise ship off the coast of southeast Alaska. After about 15 FBI agents conducted approximately 200 passenger and crew interviews in Juneau, the agency announced the charge at a news conference today and released their account of what happened. KTOO's Trip Krause has more.
39-year-old Kenneth Ray Manzanares of Santa Clara, Utah, is charged in the death of Christy Manzanares. She died Tuesday. The FBI released its criminal complaint, which laid out this timeline and cited eyewitness accounts. Witnesses aboard the Emerald Princess entered the couple's cabin and saw blood on Manzanares' hands and clothing. A witness asked what happened, to which he reportedly replied, "She would not stop laughing at me." According to the FBI, the witness watched Manzanares drag the woman toward a balcony. The witness pulled her back into the couple's cabin. Soon after, at about 9 p.m., Emerald Princess security and medical staff arrived. The woman was dead, with a severe head wound. Blood was throughout the room, on multiple surfaces. A cruise ship security officer restrained Manzanares, and he was arrested the next day. Alaska's acting U.S. Attorney Brian Schroeder said Manzanares is charged generally with murder under a federal statute that includes a first and second degree component. The FBI noted in its complaint that Manzanares at one point said, "My life is over." Schroeder said that's not necessarily an admission of guilt.
I don't think you can burrow into the mind of one of these, of someone who's a potential defendant in a case with a comment like that and make any real conclusions.
Schroeder could not confirm whether drugs or alcohol were a factor in the incident. Manzanares made an initial appearance at 2 p.m. Thursday in federal court in Anchorage by a video conference from Juneau, where he's being held. If convicted, Manzanares could face life in prison or the death penalty and a fine of up to $250,000. He's scheduled for a preliminary hearing at 1:30 p.m. August 10th in Anchorage. Schroeder gave the alleged crime some context.
I don't remember the last time we had a murder on a cruise ship in Alaska. I've been here for 12 years, and I'm a retired Coast Guard officer, so it's the kind of thing that would mean something to me, and I don't think we've had one since I've been here.
Special Agent in Charge Marlon Ritzman said in Juneau, FBI specialists are providing assistance to family members. Schroeder and Ritzman wouldn't directly confirm that children are involved, but a reporter asked if there was support for the girls.
These girls potentially don't have parents. I mean, they don't. One's in jail and one's dead.
They have family members. There's other family members.
The investigation is ongoing. With help from Wesley Early in Anchorage, I'm Trip J. Krause in Juneau.
Still to come, finding success on Fish Creek.
I got a fish. I was out in the water. I got super wet, and my daddy scooped the fish towards me, and I got it in my net, and I pulled it up.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The Great Recession of 2008 barely reached Alaska, but decades before, the state went through a fiscal collapse that was much worse. It was a classic oil town bust. This summer, Alaska's Energy Desk is bringing you a series called Midnight Oil about the state's long, complicated relationship with the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. The state is 2 years into the first recession since the 1980s, so Elizabeth Jenkins wondered, could the extremes of that bust happen again?
Eating out wasn't just a quick bite for Pete Zimarillo. It was a sacred time when dreams were sketched in notebooks. He amassed an empire over plates of Italian or Mexican, Pete's favorite foods.
Shauna? Yeah, over there.
And he liked to arrive at a restaurant with an entourage. Patrons would look up to catch a glimpse. This guy was an Anchorage celebrity. At least, that's how Paul Gardner remembers it.
When Pete walked into a restaurant, he didn't wait for anybody to set him. He'd say, I don't need your help, I could sit myself. And he'd just walk and pick whatever table and sit down, and then they just have to deal with him.
Paul dealt with Pete for decades, first as an employee and later a friend. Zimarillo died about 3 years ago, and Paul is now the trustee of his estate. Today we're grabbing lunch at the Denali Family Restaurant in Wasilla.
What's your specials?
There is a chicken salad.
When Pete was alive, he owned this place. And back when oil was booming, Pete shaped the landscape of Alaska's largest city, Anchorage. But he grew up on the island of Cephalonia, which is part of Greece. When Pete first arrived in Alaska in the 1960s, he made money buying and selling oil leases. Then he sold a few houses. And by the 1970s, he turned his sights to strip malls. People called him the Strip Mall King. And Pete, he wasn't offended.
Oh, yeah. He was proud of the Strip Mall King.
Pete Zimarillo wore $1,000 suits paired with cheap shoes, all bushy sideburns and big sunglasses. You could catch him driving around town in a blue Lincoln Continental. But Pete built an extravagant lifestyle on top of a shaky foundation, the conviction that Alaska's oil boom would never end.
He was the first time I ever heard someone say, I'm too big to fail.
That's state economist Neil Fried.
You know, that term wasn't invented just recently, you know, in that last great recession in the 2000s. He was saying, well, you know, I owe the bank so much, there's no way they're going to close on me.
Alaska Mutual was just one of the financial institutions that loaned Pete Zimarillo money. Kevin Toon worked there. He was in his late 20s at the time, with a mustache and a rat tail haircut. He tucked the 8-inch tail of hair into the collar of his suits. Kevin wasn't a lending guy. He was a bank auditor. But he saw some of the loans that went out the door. And he remembers, by the late 70s, it was kind of bonkers.
I actually saw loan documentation on bar napkins in files, which I thought, you've got to be kidding me. This is just unbelievable. So you're lending on a financial statement created on a bar napkin from Choku Charlie's.
Kevin says more than a dozen banks in Anchorage were competing for customers. They cut deals, like allowing them to have no down payment. In the heyday, Pete Zimarillo was borrowing from at least 15 different banks. Then in the first half of 1986, the price of oil crashed. It fell nearly 70%. That, combined with the overbuilt real estate market in Anchorage, caused the state's economy to suddenly fall off a cliff. Newspaper articles from the time described the housing market in free fall and condominium complexes as ghost towns as owners abandoned their properties. Paul Gardner says Pete's strip mall empire was also emptying out.
During that time, it looked really, really bleak. Pete was telling me that he had tenants coming in and just dropping the keys on his desk and leaving because they couldn't make it anymore.
In 1986, Pete Zimarillo filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. He was $150 million in debt, owing hundreds of creditors. Kevin Toon says Alaska Mutual was also struggling. The bank relied heavily on real estate lending, loaning to commercial developers like Pete Zimarillo, and also regular homeowners. It was a great business to be in during the boom years. But as business owners defaulted on their loans and homeowners started handing in their keys,
you could see the banks going one after another. You know, First Interstate, Continental Bank, People's Bank.
It was a busy time for the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or as you probably know them, the FDIC. The agency helped work out a deal for Alaska Mutual to merge with another bank in an effort to keep the bank's doors open, but it was still at risk of being shut down by the FDIC. So at the end of each week, Kevin sat back and waited.
You know, every Friday, everybody was going, all right, is this going to be the day? Is this going to be the day? Is this going to be the day? And I still remember sitting in the corner office of our executive vice president looking out the window going, okay, there's the rental cars we're expecting. And they came in and, you know, you're first kind of shocked, even though you knew it was coming. But the fact of the matter is probably 300 people just lost their job effectively at 6 o'clock that night.
Kevin and his colleagues were asked to return to the bank on a Saturday while the FDIC went through the bank's numbers.
And they were absolutely shocked. The first thing out of the one individual's mouth was he said, this is what we're going to have to do. We're going to have to go back. We're going to have to get additional people.
The FDIC had a small office in town already, but this bank failure called for a much bigger presence in Anchorage. So the FDIC moved into a large glass office building in Midtown, and there was a bright side.
They hired virtually everybody back.
Kevin and his colleagues had new jobs with the FDIC, because who better to try to get rid of the bad loans than the very people who helped create them?
I don't think that ended up being any sort of problem, but it's an interesting dynamic when you have somebody collecting on a loan that they did.
When it was all over, the FDIC ended up closing 10 failed banks in Alaska. The state's economy started growing again in late 1988, but the real estate market took much longer to recover. Since those days, the economy chugged along, growing modestly for nearly 30 years. But things have changed. We're now in the first recession since the 1980s. And in some ways, it's still the same old story. The price of oil dropped dramatically in 2015, which meant billions of dollars in state revenue vanished. The oil industry has lost thousands of jobs. But economist Neil Fried says what's happening now is not the same.
I mean, there's just monstrous differences between now and then.
In the early 80s, there were too many condos and houses being built. Right now, Anchorage has a tight housing market, and nearly 2 years into the recession, prices are flat. The population is also a lot more stable. Back then, the median age in Alaska was 26. When things got bad, people picked up and moved. That's just not as easy for most people today. Another key difference, Alaska has a lot more savings in the bank. It all sounds good, right? But here's the thing. This time, it's not a classic oil town bust. Alaska's recession now is a lot less predictable. Even if the price of oil jumps again, it won't save the state's economy because there's a lot less oil in the pipeline.
And these are sort of uncharted waters. This is, again, they are uncharted waters, which does create uncertainty. I mean, I wish they've, you know, if this is just a classic boom bust, I wouldn't be worried about it at all.
When Neil was going through the airport security line in Anchorage recently, a TSA agent pulled him aside and asked him if he should buy a house. It's a question he gets a lot these days. He told the man the same thing he tells everyone who asks. It depends on your situation.
I'm generally a pessimist, but what I do know, because I've been doing this long enough, is that the optimists typically have been right more often than the pessimists. And that gives me some optimism.
He says it's impossible to say what the future holds for Alaska's economy. But the state learned a humbling lesson during the 80s bust. There's a big difference between being an optimist and believing you're too big to fail. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
This story is part of Alaska Energy Desk's podcast called Midnight Oil. To hear more, go to alaskapublic.org or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
A veterans town hall featuring Dr. Timothy Ballard will take place on August 1st from 5 to 6:30 p.m. in the Mendenhall Valley Public Library in Juneau. The VA welcomes frank and open discussions of veterans' concerns in all program areas. Time will be made available for individuals to address their concerns in one-on-one sessions. For more information, email samuel.hudson@va.gov. This message sponsored by the VA.
Anchorage voters will decide next spring how public bathrooms are going to be regulated. According to the municipal clerk's office, a controversial initiative has gathered enough signatures from supporters to go before voters on the April 3rd ballot in 2018. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports.
The measure seeks to regulate bathrooms, locker rooms, and other so-called intimate spaces on the basis of biological sex rather than gender identity, as is the current policy. If a majority of voters approve the item, it would amend a 2015 law passed by the Anchorage Assembly barring discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity in housing, employment, and public facilities. A large amount of the organizing around the initiative has come from Alaska Family Action, which calls itself a public policy ministry standing for conservative values. Supporters say the policy change will protect their privacy in places like locker rooms and give churches and private businesses the ability to regulate bathrooms in line with their beliefs. The ballot measure has already sparked controversy and an opposition campaign among those who say it would discriminate against transgender residents. Coalition of groups opposed to the measure called Fair Anchorage says they'll focus on a public education campaign over the next several months. In a statement today, Anchorage Mayor Ethan Berkowitz called the measure divisive and distracting, saying he opposes it. The same election in April determines who will be the city's next mayor. Berkowitz has not formally announced yet whether or not he'll run for a second term. Turnout in municipal elections with a mayoral race on the ballot tend to be slightly higher. 2018 will be the first year Anchorage switches to the new vote-by-mail system. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Near Wasilla today, hundreds of salmon set to spawn in Fish Creek swam a gauntlet of dipnets after the Department of Fish and Game opened the sometimes sporadic personal-use dipnet fishery there. Early counts and projections for the near future indicate a strong enough sockeye run. For local fish biologists and dipnetters alike, Fish Creek is a hands-on, full-spectrum salmon experience right in their backyard. Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove and Henry Leisha were there too and have this audio postcard.
We are at Fish Creek checking out the personal use fishery and trying to determine how busy it is down here, kind of how successful the dip netters have been, and enjoying the day. My name is Samantha Osland. I'm the Assistant Area Management Biologist for the Sport Fish Division here. We're actually standing in Fish Creek, 6 inches deep, and it's a beautiful day. A few fish passing by as we're standing here. We watch daily fish passages, and so as the fish trickle in, we watch that very closely, and we're looking to hit our escapement, and we want to land somewhere in the middle there, but we have to project that we're going to have 35,000 fish in river before we can open the fishery.
I ended up catching 10. Yeah, I've been doing it since the 80s here, so I don't know, it's just smaller, it's more fun, you get more wet. Tonight, the old lady's gonna be, and her friends are gonna be in the boat, and I'm gonna be with the kids on shore, and we're just gonna play in the mud.
I got a fish. I was out in the water, I got super wet, and my daddy scooped the fish towards me, and I got it in my net, and I pulled it up.
My husband had several, but
problem is that they got away from him, or the net had a hole in it we didn't know about.
Yeah, so Alaska Wildlife Trooper Dan Dahl. We have a couple things with just public safety in mind, with the traffic and all the parking here and all the congestion from this fishery. But also, there's a couple lines to enforce out by the mouth to make sure they're inside and in a legal area to fish. And then once they do catch fish and they come back here to their vehicles, just to make sure they got their fish logged, the tails cut, they got a permit, and they got a fishing license in their Alaska residence. And that's kind of the things to make sure we got legal fishermen doing legal things.
I'm Clint McBride. I'm a fisheries technician too for Sportfish. So we're at the Fish Creek Weir, a couple river miles up from the mouth. And it's just a very small fixed floating weir that basically allows us to count every fish that passes. Luckily for this spot, since there's only one of us at a time, they alternate us back and forth. But you're here for like 3 to 4 days at a time, 24/7. And those breaks are very nice so that you know, you're not just out here alone, kind of going crazy. You do just find things to bring out. I play guitar, so I bring my guitar out here, books and music and the radio and, you know, just stuff to keep yourself occupied.
Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove and Henry Leisha produce the postcard. The Fish Creek Personal Dipnet Fishery is expected to remain open each day from 6 a.m. to 11 p.m. until Monday. The limit is 25 fish per head of household and 10 more for each family member. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Elizabeth Harbaugh and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Casey Grove and Henry Leisha in Wasilla, Trip Krause, Elizabeth Jenkins, and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, and Dave Benninger in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, taking pride in its strong ties to Alaskans and in the 40 years of Alaska operations.
And by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to young people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided in all the training programs, from accounting services to security and protective services. Tweet hashtag CareersBeginHere to learn more. This message is sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.